thank you for the chance to be with these saints. And I pray that as we consider media, that you'll give us some good insight and help us to be more fruitful and effective for you. And I thank you for the lifelong ministry that you give us and help us to be really good at it. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. At one time, I was the Jack Kwok of Indiana, so to speak. I was a state exec in Indiana, and I ended up writing some columns in the state paper, and the executive board, state executive committee of the SBC said, well, come on down here and, edit our paper and be our PR guy. So I got to be the public relations vice president for the executive committee, and we made some TV ads, some PSAs, public service announcements, and we also added to the magazine we started called SBC Life. And so I was doing PR, and I thought, well, wait a second. I was a philosopher, and I was a pastor, and PR doesn't sound good at all. I mean, that's whenever you say PR, you almost have to say just in front of it. Like, well, that's just PR. You know, how would you like to have a job? Like, oh, well, that's just the pastor. Or, no, it's just PR. So I thought it wasn't dignified. But I got to do a lot of that, and I came to realize how important it was. For one thing, the world just gets it wrong so many times. In the early church, they were saying things like, they're into cannibalism. Well, why? Because it said they ate his body and drank his blood, and so they must be cannibals. And you say, no. And then they say, that's incest, because he called her sister, and then they went home and had kids or something like that. That's not right. No, that's not what it's... Look, hate us if you will, but be sure you hate us for the right reasons. So that's a lot of what you do in PR. In fact, we had a clipping service there, and every day we would get all the clippings from everything said about the Southern Baptist Convention in the press. We first had everything. See, you have to pay $1.50 a clipping at that time. And so we would get a bundle of them, and it turns out if anyone mentioned you in an Associated Press article, then it would appear in like 150 papers. It's like we're paying like, $200 and something. So we think, no, just one mention of an AP article, but then all the extras. Boy, we had a lot of things to clear up. I mean, they would say a Baptist in the South, someone who is a Baptist and happened to be in the South, would be a Southern Baptist. And we say, no, that's not necessarily the case, So we were constantly trying to kind of put out some fires there. I'm an ROTC guy from 1970. I was commissioned in 1970 during the Vietnam War and spent 28 years in the Guard and Reserve. And when they found out in the Army that I did some public relations work, then I got a job at the Pentagon working in public relations for 7 tours. And so I would go in 2 weeks a year and work on the Army public relations desk and the press relations desk. And when the TWA 747 was shot down or went down or blew up or something off Long Island years ago. I think it was probably about 1996 or 7 or 8 or something like that. I was on the weapons desk, and I guess every 5 minutes for 2 days people called to see if all the missiles in the Army inventory were still in place and that sort of thing. So I've done some PR stuff, and I'll just mention one other thing that was interesting. When I first went to work for the SBC, the head of Baptist Press and I flew into Washington, rented a car, and went up the East Coast talking to every religion writer that we could talk to, because we were right in the middle of a big convention controversy over inerrancy. And we started in Washington with U.S. News and World Report, Washington Post, Washington Times, and USA Today over in Rosslyn. And then it was the Baltimore Sun, and the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the New York Times, and Time Magazine, and Religious News Service, and Associated Press, and the Hartford Courant, and the Providence Journal, and the Boston Globe, and so forth. And we're just working up there. And learned a lot, actually, about connecting up with the press. So I'm going to throw out about 15 things, lessons learned, and we're talking about dealing with the media. And it is always exciting to deal with the media. After you give an interview, that's some of my deepest prayer time, I have to say. You know, someone will call the seminary from the Louisville Courier-Journal or from the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and they'll say, Mark, can you handle this one? And it's sort of like, what is your position on lethal injection? Is it cruel and unusual punishment? Or is the seminary too... are they being fair to Rob Bell or something like that? And then you talk for about 10 minutes with the reporter and you have no idea if he got it right or what he's going to use or if he's going to put your grammatical mistakes out there or if you've misrepresented the seminary. So it's pretty exciting stuff. Well, just let's race through this, some lessons learned, all right? First, you know the expression, if it leads, it bleeds. They do love conflict. And so I remember, you know, the religion writers only have so much money to go to conferences. They can't go to every religion conference, denominational conference, and so they want to know where the fight's going to be. So they call around before the meetings. I call the Presbyterians and the Methodists and Nazarene Pentecostals, Southern Baptists, and say, okay, what are you guys going to do this year? And I'll say, we're going to suspend meeting on Tuesday night and just have a prayer for spiritual awakening and renewal. And they say, yeah, fine, okay. And we're going to go knock on doors in Las Vegas and or someplace and tell people about the gospel and just spread out all over. Oh, yeah, fine, you know. And there'll be a fist fight in aisle three. You know, wait, slow down. How do you spell that? And you're going to start typing. And so they'll come to you if they think there's going to be a fight. So don't expect to be gratified if, you know, you take them some good news about a bunch of conversions, you know, or the expansion of your mission force or something like that. That's boring to them. They just take that as you know, PR from you. But if it's going to be some kind of fight or even where they can put you in a bad light, we visited Laura Sessions Stepp at the Washington Post, and she was a Methodist minister's daughter from near Fort Smith. And I remember when we talked to her about her work on the religion beat, and she was very kind to us, but she said, well, it used to be when I did religion that I would be relegated to like the garden club reports, you know, and so-and-so had a tea party over, you know, way back in the back. And then when Jim Baker and Jimmy Swaggart had a scandal or two, she said, I'm front page now. She says, I'm hot stuff here at the Post. Well, they were waiting around for some kind of embarrassment to the church. So once you know that, you're not just crushed if they put bad news. That's just what they do. I mean, it's just sort of like being frustrated that a tiger is a carnivore or something like that. Second, they have this little phrase that is really kind of a dangerous phrase. I mean, they think it sounds really cool, and I've seen it quoted again and again. Our job is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. I don't know if you've ever heard that, but that's a standard journalistic thing. And so they see themselves as the champion of the little guy, and you know, kind of the one who slaps around the power people. And that really sounds righteous. I mean, if you can bring down a president or, you know, find somebody sleeping in a refrigerator box somewhere under the interstate, then, you know, and show how they've been wrong, then that's a good day's work. The problem is, and a lot of times it's good, but the problem is it really does make them counterculture. You know, let's just say who's comfortable. Well, back in the 50s, it would be people who would have, like, healthy families and raise their kids, you know, two parents in the home and raise their kids with Bible studies at home and, you know, well-behaved at school and this kind of thing. Those are the comfortable. And the uncomfortable would be, like, let's just say, a scatological or obscene comedian like Lenny Bruce or something like that. So your job, then, is to take this guy who's a foul-mouthed comedian or whatever. I mean, he had some moments, but and kind of lift him up as a martyr. And then if someone's like Ozzie and Harriet or, you know, kind of a healthy, you do something to find some dirt on them or to drag them down. Well, I'm just thinking, well, if that's your watchword, let's see what you're going to do with pedophiles. I mean, they're afflicted. Can you make them more likable? And, you know, if somebody is in the majority in a town, can you then, it's sort of like, where does this stop? Maybe it happens in when the Christians start to become martyrs in America or something like that, then they'll finally do some nice work on us. But anyway, that's a kind of watchword that gets them into a certain mode of thinking. Another thing I learned is familiarity breeds contempt. I don't know if you've ever heard that expression before. Sometimes you're so close to something, it's like a prophet who's without honor in his own country, you know. And I found this in the press. As we were dealing with the different writers, the religion writers, Herb Hollinger was Baptist press head, and I was the VP for PR. We discovered that those in the South were much more likely to be prickly and snotty toward us. Like Methodist, I think Helen Parmley at the Dallas Morning News, I think is where she was. Helen Parmley was really prickly toward us, and so was Gail White at the Atlanta Constitution. But then when we went north and met Ari Goldman at the New York Times or Michael Hursley, Ari was Jewish, Michael Hursley at the Chicago Sun-Times, who was Catholic, they treated us with more respect because there weren't that many Baptists, Southern Baptists, where they were. And so they treated us as a sort of like interesting people group or something like that, like we were the Maasai or something, I don't know what. And they kind of listened to us and, you know, went along sort of what we said. I mean, they weren't in our pocket, but at least they treated us with some respect. So you would think that you'd brace yourself against a New York Jewish writer, but you would often get much better treatment than a cranky Methodist in Dallas who'd been around Southern Baptists all her life and so forth. So it was an interesting surprise. They really do get the social part right. That's the next thing I'll say. They understand, let's just assume that most religion writers or most press people are not born again, just for sake, just a wild stretch here. They do get social gospel. For example, you, like I say, we had a, when I was coming into the office there, we had an incredible movement of God in East Africa. It was the Mombasa or the Kenyan Coastal Crusade, centered on Mombasa, and there were tens of thousands of people converted and baptized, and churches started, and it was in a heavy Muslim area, and that seemed, that seemed like wonderful. Like, hey, let's run with that. But no, that's of no interest whatsoever. But when we lifted up disaster relief work, you know, where a lot of them are retirees in like little yellow ball caps, and when there's a tornado that sweeps through Bedford, Indiana, or someplace like that, and before dawn, you've got like six crews from Ohio with a feeding station, and you've got the Red Cross in there bringing their food so the Baptists can cook it up and distribute it and so forth. We're really good at that. And I am delighted, as a PR guy, I was delighted to lift that up. Well, they just went for that because, you know, or World Changers where they're, you know, helping build houses or repair houses. They love that. I'm delighted they are, but it's a shame they don't appreciate, you know, prayer walking and conversions and backyard Bible club and stuff like that. But, you know, it's you do something. We, in our own town where I pastor, we have a thing called Alley Sheep as opposed to Alley Cats. We have a lot of restaurants downtown Evanston. And so we put on these vests or T-shirts that say Alley Sheep, and we have these little trash poker things and bags with stickers that say Serving Evanston in Jesus' Name. And we have a little cards that talk about why we're the sheep of his pasture and, you know, why we're just testifying. Well, Evanston is an affluent area, and they love the looks of their town and their property values and all that. So we're just going around picking up trash that's spilled out of dumpsters and blown up against fences and stuff like that, and people ask you, what are you doing? And they're thankful, and they might even help a little bit. Well, that's social stuff. You know, that's serving the aesthetic look of the community. And they like that. But if we're, like, witnessing door-to-door, they won't like that. So you don't avoid the social stuff. You just understand that that's about all they can understand, really. In addition to scandal, that's kind of. So look, think about it. They like visuals too. When I was the exec in Indiana, we had simultaneous revivals, and we got this cross. There's an old guy named Arthur Blessed who used to carry a cross across the nation, and anyway, we made one up at the state camp. It was a big old thing, and we signed up Hoosier Baptist to carry it from like Gary down to Louisville, essentially to Jeffersonville. And so we're walking along and we're announcing, here's hope, God, Jesus cares for you, revivals. And we have an incredible range of press coverage. It's such a great visual of people trudging along. And we dragged it for a while without a wheel and it started to wear down. So we decided we're going to have a toothpick when we get to Indiana, to Louisville, if we don't put a wheel on the back of this thing. So we did that and it was it was impressive. So anyway, we got a lot of attention because of the visuals there. I would say be as friendly and as helpful as you can. You can't assume that they're going to be your friend, but you can surely be friendly. You know, I mean, we're not in charge of the universe, and, you know, God is. And so we can just act our best and hope that things work out well. Be as helpful as you can. All right? We had good contact with a lady at USA Today. She's still there. She's the chief religion writer, and her name is Kathy Grossman. It turns out she went to Northwestern Journalism School, which is where I work, and so we even have that contact. But when Herb and I went into USA Today to meet Kathy Grossman, we were thinking, oh my, you know, a Washington national newspaper Jewish lady, oh, this is going to go well. We're the fundies, you know, from the Southern Baptist Convention. And she said, listen, I know what you guys are trying to do. She says, we have a group of Jewish families who are trying to keep our traditions alive by spinning the dreidel and having the Seder plate and all this kind of stuff. And she says, I know what you guys are doing. You're trying to hold on to your traditions. That wasn't the whole thing, but like, wow, you know. So she respected us for standing with it. And from that day, you know, she's called me at least once a year to say, hey, here's a story. Can I get a quote? And she'll say, hey, I see stuff about these workbooks you guys are doing or something. I saw an Experiencing God thing by Henry Blackaby. And is that? And so I went over to the Baptist bookstore, Lifeway, and got about, I think about 12 of them. Like, I don't know, it was like T.W. Hunt and, you know, K. Arthur or something. I can't remember what they all were. And I just bundled them up, and it was worth probably a couple of $100, but I just bundled them and FedExed them to her as out of my office. And she just knows that I'll just be there with the answers and the stuff. When I worked at the Pentagon, you know, they would call in from Rock and Ice magazine and say, in California, we fire anti-tank rounds into the snow masses to set free avalanches so that the skiers don't have avalanches. You know, they shoot cannons into the anti-tank weapons into the avalanche areas to set it free so that the people can ski. But every once in a while, a round doesn't go off. And so they have to have this California National Guard unit to go up and get the unexploded rounds, and they wanted stuff. And so I scramble all around the Pentagon, and I get photographs of the different weapons and photographs of this and that. And so what I'm saying is when they call you and they want to know, well, what's Southern Baptist's position on the disinterment of Native American graves? You know, well, I don't know. I don't think we have a position. I mean, that's a call I got once. But know people who know people who know people who can tell you. Call the SBC and say, have we ever voted on that? Is there anything? Has the Christian Life Commission ever spoken on that? Has a professor ever written a book on that? Is there whatever? And do legwork, and pretty soon you'll be on their Rolodex, you know? And if you call back, and one thing you can do when they're asking for a quote, unless they're just instantly they need something. I mean, by the way, if they ask you for a quote, you can say, I really don't know anything about that or something, you know, if it's true. Or you could just, but pray an instant prayer like, oh God, please help me. Just what I say, please be the Lord of this. One thing you can do if you've got a moment says, listen, I will get right back to you. Give me your email and I'll send you a quote. And again, like there was a guy who shot some people on the Long Island subway or train like on Christmas Eve or something, and you know, where's God when this happens? And instead of like just spouting off, I say, can I get back to you? And I probably within 20 minutes I sent an email statement back, and it was in a list of about 20 statements from Christian people. And it's good to be able to compose yourself a little bit. So, you know, nothing to be ashamed of there. Sometimes you get drawn into a situation and do you remember in the Bible where it says, when you get pulled into that situation, I'll give you the words or you'll know what to say? Sometimes you're not up to it, but I'll give you a simple example of how God provided something. We had a study in the SBC about it was the number of lost people per county in the SBC. They had this formula, like the certain percentage of Catholics, certain percentage of Baptists, certain percentage, whatever. And so, anyway, you had this kind of deal of America, and they would have like, this would be like bright red and, you know, so much, you know, LA, Las Vegas, and then other places would be yellow and other places would be orange, and they would estimate the concentration so that we could pull resources to bear on these places that were most needy. Well, anyway, they sent it out to the state evangelism departments, and there was a guy in the Alabama convention who wore two hats, evangelism and journalism, the paper. And he thought, oh, this is a great story. Southern Baptists are, you know, analyzing America for lostness. And so he, as the paper editor, did a little piece on that thing, did a press release. Well, I think it was Greg Garrison at the Birmingham News picked that up and said, well, uh-huh, you're saying half of Alabama's going to hell, you know, or something like that. And like, oh, what were you thinking? And I mean, the Associated Press picked it up. It went all over the universe. And it's like, oh God, just kill us, you know, now. But and they had more fun with the headlines. I mean, one of them was really sophisticated. It was sticks and stones. Well, sticks and stones will break your bones, but you know, words will never hear. The river Styx is the river in what is it in Dante's? Is it Dante's Inferno? or where they're going across the river Styx to Hades, to hell. And so they were using that play on words. Or it's just like Southern Baptists catch hell for study or something. You know, it was just fun. We, in fact, I edited SBC Life, and we had something like 20 headlines, and they ran with it all over. Well, we got a call from television, and it was from a public television in Chicago, and there was a lady named Bertice Berry who used to teach sociology at Kent State, actually, and she was doing stand-up at night, and she was so good at it, they hired her to have a talk show, kind of like Oprah, kind of like Jerry Springer, kind of like Charlie Rose. It was kind of a mixture. So she got us up there to defend our study. Well, I was on the program. Actually, they shot two programs at one time, and the other program was this Christmas special. And they had Ossie Davis and Ruby Dee being taped there, a couple of black stars. And it was fun to meet them. But for our show, they had a kind of a professional atheist named Rob Sherman, who was from Chicago. He was a lawyer, but he's kind of like Madeline Murray O'Hare. And they had a black Pentecostal preacher in a purple suit. And they had a guy from the Council of Christian and Jews. I see him on TV all the time. He's always in a poor Jewish house in Russia saying, here's this poor person. Can you give us money to get her to Israel or something like that? Or I think it's like Yekiel Eckstein or something like that. They had a Loyola professor and then myself. And the show starts with me, and it just full face. It says, this man says half of you are going to hell. I mean, that's a, you know, so we're off to the races there. And, you know, and then they had the atheist says, this man says there is no hell. And he's smiling like that. And then they had the Pentecostal preacher and said, this man, you're going to hell if you wear a pantsuit, if you're a woman or something. Yeah, it was just all this stuff. So it was kind of a circus. And it's interesting that we were all talking in the green room and the production assistant came in and said, whoa. And she grabbed me and the preacher and took us to another room. And we thought, what's the problem? She says, we don't want you guys to become friends here. We got no show, you know. So anyway, Bertice finally got us all together and said, listen, interrupt me, interrupt each other. Don't just let me ask a question, then answer. Question number two, answer. Interrupt each other, you know, stir it up. Well, you know, I was kind of the goat. But by God's grace, the other preacher was so wacky in a way because he was saying, you know, you'd go to hell if you wore a pantsuit or something like that. He was such a legalist that I came off looking more like C.S. Lewis. And I even wore like tweed there, you know, so they would know that I was cool. And so finally we had the introductions and then she turned to me and sort of pressed the question. And it was like, you know, well, are you saying such and such? And I said, well, and here's the thing that God gave me. Chuck Kelly, who's president of New Orleans Seminary, earlier had said, we were in a committee meeting, he said, there's one thing worse than being lost, and that's being lost and no one is looking for you. And he says, Southern Baptists are concerned that the lost have someone looking for them. And I'm telling you, there was a sea change in the room. It was just, it was kind of like, you know, Jerry Springer-ish kind of, you know, excitement. And then all of a sudden, they just kind of got quiet, and they thought, wow. We disagree with the guy, but hey, you know, and that was a gift from God. And in working with the press, God will give you gifts that are beyond your wits. I don't know if you're counting these. Number seven, when I worked in the Pentagon, we had a thing called a murder board, which is a lovely sound. But what happens is if a spokesman is going to go before the press, for a couple of hours or at least an hour beforehand, we all get together and bombard him or her with insulting questions. And that's the murder board. We convene a murder board. Well, there was a general who was going to speak about there being an exit on the interstate by North Fort Hood down in Central Texas. And, you know, some were saying, oh, this is a great big waste of money. And, you know, how in the world can they get preferential treatment when they're not putting exits on interstates other places? And it's just one of those kind of snotty things about defense expenditures or too much leverage and the like. And so I was just, I think I was a colonel at the time, but then there were others who were there who were sergeants. And we sat down with that general and we just bombarded him with questions. It's like, U.S. News and World Report was going to do the interview. And it's like, can I talk that way to a general? May I talk that way to a general? Yeah, right now you can. And so it's not bad to game what they might ask. So you're not just flustered if they ask something. And by the way, here's what they do. This is the pattern. They start charming, and then they come with that zinger, You know, it's sort of like, hey, oh, you're from Arkansas? Man, I just love that Bill Clinton, you know, who's the guy? Billy Ray Thornton. Is he from Arkansas? I thought so. Yeah, he went to college in Henderson State, and that's right across from where I went to college, in Wachita Baptist. And did you ever see him? No. Say, well, I was a wife and kids. Yeah. What'd you think about the bracket? You know, did you pick Louisville? No. And say, and you talk a while, and they ask a few softball questions like, okay, now the Southern Baptist Convention was founded in what year? And have you ever spoken on this? That's good. And then the last question is, have you stopped beating your wife? You're like, whoa, what was that? But that's the only one they want to ask. That's the zinger. But they soften you up, and they soften you up. And then like, oh, this is great. This is going great. I may get a Pulitzer for just being in this article, you know. And then they pull this zinger, you know, like, why is Paul Pressler so mean? Or like, well, have you read this thing about so-and-so? And it's like, oh, boy, you know. So you be on your guard, and there's a thing that you say. You can't say retroactively, this is off the record, by the way. You can't say it and say, now that's off the record. Uh-uh. Once it's out, it's on the record, all right? But if you can get them to agree beforehand. Now, what I'm going to tell you, is this off the record? Yes, and you have to trust them, you know. Yes, it is. Then you talk and say, okay, we're back on the record. But you have to be very, very careful about that. And if you're going to have a meeting, then they have these different rules where if it's a meeting, we're going to have, I forget the name of it, but we have rules that you don't attribute a quote to somebody. You can quote something said, but you can't attribute it to a person. You have to put the ground rules out. Otherwise, assume they will take everything. It's almost like the Miranda. Assume that everything you say could be used against you in a court of law on the front page of the New York Times. I would say just know your stuff. Know your stuff. Biblically, you know, you ought, one reason we have seminary is so that you know the difference between Abishag and Ashkelon. You know that you can kind of know if somebody says, "Oh, that's the documentary hypothesis," or "That's the Greek word for sheep," or something. Then you're able to kind of come from that. But if it has to do with Baptist affairs or public policy things, you kind of ought to know your stuff. If they're going to talk about Islam being a religion of peace, if you're going to speak about that, then you need to have read a little bit on Islam and be familiar with it. Don't just wade out into some area that you have no... Often you just know somebody, and you say, I don't really know that, but if you'll call Dr. Mueller at the seminary, he'll tell you about it, or something like this. I would say you should feel free to make suggestions if you think they're getting it wrong. You're not just passive and just like hoping that they'll get it right. One thing I noticed again and again, they were referring, Associated Press particularly, was referring to the people who were for biblical inerrancy as fundamentalists. And then they were referring to the people who said, lighten up, don't change anything, as moderates. And I thought, that's not fair. Moderate sounds great. Fundamentalist sounds raw. And I said, look, fair is fair. And the guy, by the way, I'll say that the religion chief religion writer for Associated Press in those days was a guy named George Cornell. He's an old fella. And I just contacted George, and I wrote a thing to the Press in general. And I said, look, if you're going to use kind of the scalding word fundamentalist, then why don't you use the scalding word liberal? You know, that's kind of like a bugaboo word. But if you're going to use moderate, then why don't you say conservative? Those are the soft words. These are the raw words. You've mixed raw with soft. And he bought it. You know, I mean, he really did. And in fact, the Associated Press style book says, don't use the word fundamentalist to any group that doesn't use it for itself, because it connotes a certain anti-intellectualism and, you know, scrappiness and so forth. So sometimes, and you do it politely, but say, hey, how about this guy? And in that case, he changed. I don't know if anybody noticed, but it helped. Humor is good, too. Be able to laugh at yourself. If you're always just huffy about your dignity and stuff. When I was a pastor once in Arkansas, we sent our program out to be printed at a local printer. It was kind of a church that had a few bucks, and they did that. So we got a call one day from the printer, and I was preaching through Proverbs. And topically, you know, like I would group the Proverbs on friendship or the Proverbs on speech and the Proverbs on whatever, and I was going alphabetically. And so the first word that I had was adultery, what Proverbs had to say about adultery. That was the theme that night, adultery. And it turns out my music minister had picked the song "Why Not Tonight" for the invitation. And it's like, oh, please, you know. And so they called there and said, could we use this? He says, we listen to Paul Harvey all the time. And he's always listing these gaffes, you know. And, you know, okay, you know, we enjoy it when we hear it. So why not, you know, okay, duh, duh, duh. So, and for about a year, people would stop me. Was that your, yeah, that was our church, you know, kind of thing. And then we had the challenge of getting the replacement invitation, you know. And it's like, I surrender all, or softly and tenderly, or, I mean, you just, it's just hard to, I don't know what we ended up with, probably Joy to the World or something. Anyway, there was another case, the Sunday School Board, Lifeway, they rent studios, or they did back then out. They had these recording studios, and they would rent them out to help just supplement their funds on the weekends to various secular groups. Well, it turns out Hank Williams Jr. recorded something there. And it was the Monday night football deal. Was going, are you ready for some football? You know, that sort of thing. And he was singing stuff. But it was like beer for a beer company, too. He's doing beer stuff. Well, of course, if it bleeds, it leads. The Tennessean picked it up, and it's like, yahtzee. You know, now we've got the Baptist, you know, beer ads being recorded at Lifeway or the Sunday School Board. And they loved it. Instead of just getting all indignant, how dare you, you know, and blah, 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 we just sort of made a joke, and I just sort of sent a letter to the editor saying, kind of laughing about it a little bit. And I said, the fact that we are not easy on alcohol means that this is a story. I mean, you know, it wouldn't be a story if we didn't have some standards and so forth. But there was a little bit of kind of roll with it and say, you know, we're feeling goofy about that. Oh, sometimes, I don't know if you remember this, but you probably don't. Probably weren't born then. But back in the early 90s, two churches affirmed homosexuality in the Southern Baptist Convention. They're both in North Carolina. And one of them performed a wedding for two gay guys. And it was big. The church voted to do it, and they even registered their, you know, their china at Dillard's and stuff. I mean, it was a fancy wedding. And the other voted to license to preach. I think it was a Duke Divinity School student who was homosexual. Incidentally, Dean Smith, the coach of one of the North Carolina Tar Heels, was a member of one of these churches for a while, of all things. But we were taking steps to distance ourselves from churches that affirmed homosexuality. If a homosexual comes to a church to visit, we don't throw them out, but it's like if you're going to. So we went through a two-year process of amending the Constitution of the SBC to exclude churches which affirmed homosexuality. Well, it was a public relations disaster. Have you ever heard that expression, public relations disaster? The clipping service just blew up really big, you know, and there was even a lesbian columnist in the Detroit area, Detroit News, I think, named Deb something. And then there was this liberal talk show guy out of Atlanta named Al Nusifora, and he had me on his like 2 or 3 hour talk show, night talk show twice, where I'm the redneck, and he has the gays call in and talk about how firm they, you know, they feel in their homosexuality. And a lot of people were saying, oh, this is a disaster. We could have done so much. Why did we do this? And everybody, and you say, whoa, you don't understand. The church is a public relations disaster. I mean, now, let that sink in a little bit here. But you realize Jesus, you know, beware when all men speak well of you. And Jesus was actually a pretty good exemplar of Christianity, and they killed him. Most people are not going to heaven. So most people will not be amused with the pure preaching, teaching, application of the gospel and the Bible. So in many cases, what you do when they say it's a public relations disaster, you own it. You say, yeah, spell my name right. That's who we are. That's what we do. And I just think we have so many people in Christian history who have tried to think, oh, how can we make them like us? Or like, oh, let's not ever talk about hell. Let's not ever talk about this or that. Then, because they won't like us. Listen, if they're lost, they're not going to like you. I mean, they'll like the fact that you cleaned up trash in the town and, you know, that they brought a potluck, you brought a potluck, you know, a casserole to a hungry neighbor. But in terms of, like, the edge of the gospel and the truth of Scripture and so forth, it ain't going to happen that you're going to be everybody's darling. So don't run away from it. If it's truly what's in the Bible, then embrace it and be it. Now, when they misrepresent you, set the record straight. No, we're not cannibals. You know, we're just this and that. Okay. It is kind of interesting. I don't know, when I was in the military, we read a book called Sun Tzu's Art of War. It was The Art of War by a guy named Sun Tzu. And he said one of the things in battle, he says, you've got to be flexible in battle, and it just develops like water going downhill. When water's going downhill and it hits a boulder, it doesn't go bonk, you know, and stop. It goes around the boulder. You know, it finds its way. And so I would say there's no way to, you can have like a press strategy, you know, like we will release one press release a month, and we will emphasize this month, that, and this, and we'll have these visuals, and you're going to do the photo. You can be as cagey as you want to be, but a lot of what you do is in the heat of battle. And sometimes you just spin. I work for a website called Kairos Journal out of New York, and it's funded by the retired CEO of American Standard Corporation. And anyway, we try to give pastors materials to engage the culture prophetically. Well, one of the friends of the publisher is in a very exclusive school in New York. And Jackie Kennedy went to the school, by the way. I think that's what I heard. And they had a day of silence for homosexuals who have been silenced. You know, so these little kids, I mean, they're like middle schoolers, you know, have to have sensitivity sessions and a day of silence for the persecuted gays. Well, I live in the most gay suburb in Chicago. We have more gay households, about 1,000. And I've subbed in the schools, and they'll have like, you know, pink triangles and rainbows and safe zones for gay kids to go into. I'll tell you what's not safe in my town. It's like saying homosexuality is not right. That's the danger. But anyway, they're going through this, and one of the parents said, hey, you know, what is this? What is this indoctrination of my kid in the normalization of homosexuality and the abuse of people who raise a question about it? So the publisher asked a couple of us on the team just to write something, and one thing led to another, and my little piece had like 10 reasons why this is a bad idea, and it went up on American Spectator online. It's a kind of a magazine out of Washington, and they printed it out, and they took it back, and they changed the policy at the school, and they withdrew and kind of cowed. The parents were just upset, and you can't imagine how God can use something you wrote to just change something. So understand that's a ministry. It's a ministry of writing and speaking. Speech codes are terrible right now. Boy, it is gotcha time, you know. On campus, you've got all kinds of stuff about, we have a very prominent Gilbert presence at Northwestern University. It's gay, lesbian, transgendered, bi. That's just an acronym, Gilbert, but they're big, and they've just had a huge sex ed scandal at Northwestern. I don't know if you followed, just crazy stuff they've done there. But there was nary a word from the chaplain's office, you know, about this is unseemly or something like that, because it might offend some who said that there are no limits in sexuality. You can do the same thing with race, you can do the same thing with gender, you can do the same. I mean, it's just there's no end to it. And so we're going to live increasingly in an environment where if your pastor just plainly preaches through Romans 1, then he could be guilty. I think within my lifetime it's quite possible. There may be a backlash now, but quite possible that pastors will be fined or imprisoned for hate speech, for just preaching pure biblical truths. You think, well, that couldn't happen in the West. That's like Saudi Arabia or Mogadishu. No, no, no. We've met a pastor in Sweden who did this, Åke Green. And he's like a 66-year-old Pentecostal pastor, and he's out on an island that has more cows than people. And they had this big gay pride thing coming up Stockholm, I guess. And he said, I need to prepare a sermon on what the Bible says about homosexuality. And he started like in November, and he was working up to March. I mean, he's a simple guy, and he's just been working on this deal. And he told the local radio station that he was going to do this. Well, boy, they passed it on to the rainbows or whatever. The next thing you knew, he was fined and charged to desist or something, and he appealed it and went all the way to the Supreme Court of Sweden. And it turns out, I'm told, that when he was hauled before the Supreme Court, they said, well, what exactly did you say? And then on national radio, he got to repeat the sermon, which was kind of funny. And he became such a celebrity that the Polish parliament had him over to speak about this, you know, because they're not quite as liberal on these things. But that's Sweden, which is supposed to be very liberal. Meanwhile, there's a guy named Daniel Scott, a Christian math professor from Pakistan, fled to southern Australia, to Melbourne, was teaching in university there. 9-1-1 happened, and a church said, explain to us, what are these Muslims? What do they want? You know, you're from that country. And he spoke, and it went so well, he had to speak in other churches. And some Muslims spied him out, and they said, you've vilified our religion. There's a judge, Higgins, I think his name was, who said, you have to take out $80,000 in ads in the Melbourne papers apologizing to Muslims for vilifying their religion. And he's a very tender, sweet guy named Daniel Scott. I'm kind of talking like he does. He's very sitting like this. I mean, and he says, you love them, but you here's the problem. Well, it went all the way to the Supreme Court of Australia. Finally, they said the Muslims have to pay court costs, and they remanded the case, and he finally won. I had the joy, my boss does this, but he gave me the joy of calling him one night and said, you have gotten the Kairos Journal Annual Award, Standing in the Gap Award, and we will fly you and your family to New York, and we're going to put 200 people up in the Midtown Manhattan Hilton, and we'll have this big banquet at the Metropolitan Club in New York, and you'll get a $35,000 gift in a silver Tiffany tray, and we will honor you as Kairos Journal Man of the Year. You know, when I was a little guy in Australia, I got such a kick, and we did it, you know. But that's Australia, which is liberal, free speech, et cetera, et cetera. Things like that have happened in Canada with Mark Stein. I'm just telling you, we're not immune to this sort of thing, whether you have criticized Islam, homosexuality, you know, aspects of feminism, whatever, just get ready. I just think since by the way, Watergate, the press is very anti-authority thing. They just, if they can just bring somebody down, a Richard Nixon or somebody, that's just like catnip to them. So understand, they're thinking Pulitzer, you know, prize. By the way, one of the great ways to take a kind of leery view of the press is to actually read a story about something you know a lot about. And when you read it, you're like, wait, why did they quote that guy? You know, like, what did he know? We're like, no. I mean, even in the military, they would call anything that had some armor on it and treads a tank. Well, no, an armored personnel carrier or a personnel carrier is not a tank. But, you know, or a pistol's not a gun. You know, I mean, I'm just saying they're lying, or they'll get something wrong even about doctrine. You know, they'll say, you know, oh, those Calvinists or those Arminians or those whatever. They don't know much. And so you're just very patient. Look, we're about out of time, but let me just mention how this whole Egypt thing and Tunisia, you know, and all the blow up in Yemen and Libya and the like. Some of them have no idea what Islam is. They just don't know. It's a religion of peace, and you know, now they have freedom and they'll come up. There are real barriers to democracy and religion and peace under Islam, just genetically, and they haven't studied. They don't know what dhimmi is. I mean, that's just one word that you never hear in the press, but it's a huge Muslim dhimmi. Dhimmi. Dhimmitude is the second class and worst status that Christians have in Muslim countries. They do not have the freedom that we give them here. You traditionally either you converted when the Muslims stretched in. Came in, or you fled, or put to death, or you paid a tax and you just knuckled under and you behaved. And even in the most, I guess how you'd say it, even in the most kind of liberal Muslim countries, you're second-class citizens. You don't have the same freedom. I mean, to build a mosque in Egypt, I mean, I've been in with a team that biked from Luxor to Aswan, handing out tracts up the Nile Valley, and had been consigned to hotel house arrest because of witnessing in Egypt, and I've been in Sudan and Khartoum and different places, and I'm just telling you, this is the way it is. You don't have religious freedom in those countries. You can't street preach. You can't just build a church. In Egypt, it used to be you had to get the president of the country's clearance to build an addition on a church in Egypt, whereas some guy can just go down to the mosque supply store, get a little onion dome or something like that, or a crescent, and slap it on his neighborhood deli, and you got a mosque. And you know, you can't. Now, the Orthodox have learned to be well behaved, and not, you know, the Coptics or whatever group you've got of the Orthodox. But if you're really evangelical, you're in a bind, and you can't witness, you can't convert in Saudi Arabia. It's a death sort of thing. And so even in liberal Egypt, it's very, 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 very different. The Muslim Brotherhood, Sharia law, you hear a little bit about that. You don't hear about strategic lying, the principle of taqiyya, where you say what you need to do to get advantage in matters of religion. Yasser Arafat was a master of that. He'd go sign some document talking about peace for Israel, and then he'd go back and get on the radio in Gaza and just say, let's kill them. You know, I mean, it's just because they say it. And then, like, what about the Muslim Brotherhood? Have you read the Quran? Have you read the Hadith? They're in no position to really tell you how. Look, Islam is it's so toxic. I think it was Bernard Lewis said that if you take all the manufactured exports of the Islamic world from West Africa, from Mauritania, whatever, all the way to Bangladesh, and add them together, dozens of countries, the manufactured exports of the Muslim countries are less collectively than that of Finland alone. If it weren't for oil, nothing, you know, essentially. There would be, you know, whatever. You'd have a little tourism in Egypt. But it's just because when Islam moves in with its tribalism, its nepotism, its subjugation of women, its rule by clerics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, its dismissal and marginalization of the infidels, who might also be really good scientists, you know, and leaders if you let them, causes a certain squalor to set in. It's just like the reverse Midas touch. What Islam touches, pardon me, turns to, in a sense, dust. And yet, they're just, it's just one religion, here's another religion, you know, whatever, how. They don't have a clue. It's just totally mysterious to them. Also, they don't have any idea that God may actually be working in affairs. When I edited SBC Life, I had the prayer leaders of the SBC to come in, from each agency, T.W. Hunt from Lifeway, Henry Blackaby from HMB at the time, Manette Drumwright from IMB, Doug Beggs from Brotherhood. And we were talking about the prayer, and this was right after the Iron Curtain had fallen. And Blackaby said, you know, in my lifetime there have been two great totalitarian dams against the free spread of the gospel. And he says, totalitarian Islam, totalitarian communism. One down, one to go. And you think, whoa. You know, when I was growing up, we had dog tags, and we had fallout shelters, and we were just under the nuclear holocaust thing at every moment. And who ever thought that the Iron Curtain would just collapse? I was with Phil Roberts from Midwestern. We were in an evangelistic service in the Kremlin. I thought I'd never see that. We were right in the middle of singing Amazing Grace in the People's Party Congress Hall or whatever that was. Duh. And so I'm thinking God may be up to something very big with the Islamic world, that they are suffering such embarrassment now that there is so much violence and so much craziness and so much backwardness and squalor that this new generation, it's happening in Iran, I think, is waking up and saying, what were we thinking? And I think there could be a great outbreak of the gospel among Muslims. And this unrest in the North Africa, Middle East area could be part of God's great plan. The press has no way of addressing that. Though Proverbs says, the heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord. Like rivers of water, he directs it wherever he pleases. He is sovereign in world affairs. And again, they can't talk about that or can't even understand that. But who knows? Well, that just jabbered about a lot of stuff. I know we're out of time and you've been very patient. But it's a really interesting world. It's kind of like, let's take a walk through the woods here. and you know, by God's grace, things happen. Things happen. And let me just add this, that if you look at the talking heads, the guys who are on the talk radio and political talk television, overwhelmingly they're Catholic and Jewish. They have traditions of discourse and argument, thinking on your feet and picking up and so forth. So you have a lot of Irish Catholics. I mean, you've got Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly and Chris Matthews. I mean, on different sides of these matters. And then Limbaugh has a Catholic background, and among the Jews, Michael Medved and Mona Charon and Bill Kristol and Al Franken. And I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And it turns out the evangelicals are a little lean. We got a Cal Thomas there and some late coming evangelicals like Fred Barnes and even Brett Hume. But we're just not much there. You know, we're out planting churches and loving people and winning to the Lord. But there is a lot to be said for raising up a generation that will get in and mix it up and be there. So we're a smaller presence than we need to be. Same with Hollywood, by the way. Mainly Catholics and Jews. I mean, you have the huge, all the major studios, MGM, Warner Brothers, Miramax, Jewish thing, the Catholic studios and the Catholic directors like Antonioni and Vincent Minnelli, and it goes on and on. But in terms of the evangelicals in Hollywood, we have some churches that are getting like small cameras and making stuff like, you know, Facing the Giants and stuff, but more cultural penetration, I think, is what we need.